Okay, so welcome everyone to our first of the installments on Megillat Esther. So before we begin, Esther, let's contextualize what we're going to do tonight. Esther is important for many reasons. It is, of all of Tanakh, it is the closest experience that we have today to what was in Tanakh. It was like the last Sefer, the last of the books of Nach, of Navi and Ketubim, to be canonized, if you will, for the lack of a better word. In fact, when they discovered the famous Dead Sea Scrolls, there was not a book of Esther. I believe it wasn't part of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was new. Okay? And in fact, the rabbis weren't so happy because they had this lady ordering them around. Basically, you know, Esther said to the Chachamim, the Yodei Itim, you know, you must do this, you must make this law, you must make that law. And again, it's not normal for a lady to have such power, right? You have to go all the way back to Deborah, to Devorah, in the time of the Shoftim, of judges, to find somebody who would order the Sanhedrin, the Beit Din, the people around. But Esther, of course, she's Esther HaMalka. So number one, it is so relevant to us today, because it's the closest experience we have. But what about the world we live in today? I believe that it is so relevant, tragically, because we live in a world, number one, of Hester Panim, where God's divine countenance is hidden from us. We don't see God. It is so easy today for people, even Jewish people, to buy into science and nature and other things, and they become, unfortunately for some people, the be-all end-all of their religious experience. And that's not a good thing, because when we ever vocalize this, like for the first time in history, we, the Jewish people, newly refreshed and released from Egyptian servitude, from the Avdut of Mitzrayim, we come to this place called Rith Vidim, and what do we say? Hayesh Hashem b'kibbeinu emayim. Is God amongst us or not? And God is like, whoa, wait a minute. Is God among you? I carried you up al kanfei sharim, on the wings of eagles. I split the sea. You guys walked through the ocean. You walked through the sea. You were there at Universal Studios. You were there. Charlton Heston led you across. You saw Yul Brynner and the Minions gone. It was the highest point of Nevi'ut, right? We're told that even the Shifcha, even the lowest maidservant, experienced a revelation at Kriyat Yam Suf, the splitting of the sea, that was beyond even later great prophets. Didn't see what they saw. So how come just a few short days removed from that experience, we're asking, Hayesh Hashem b'kibbeinu emayim, is God amongst us or not? Guess what the response of God is? Haman's great-grandfather makes his first appearance. Amalek attacks. So you have at the end of the same parsha, which ironically details the splitting of the sea, parshat b'shalach, it ends with Vayavo Amalek Vayilachem in Yisrael b'Rifidim. Along comes the Amalekite nation and they make war against us. So it's the first time, but it's not the last time. Every single time in Jewish history where the Jews question, where is God? Who is God? What's my relationship with God about? Every single time, invariably, God's response when we have safek, a doubt about God, is to send an Amalek in Jewish numerology, in Gematria, equals safek. Like when we don't know, we're not sure. God says, if you're not sure, how about I send Amalek around? Maybe you'll remember where I am. And they draw an analogy. It's in Rashi, in Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchak. It's a very powerful analogy. And the analogy is like this. What is the situation like? It's like a father who carries his little boy, precious little boy, carries him on his shoulders, takes him everywhere. Boy wants for nothing. They go to the Apple store. Dad, there's the Apple iPhone 13. Okay? Dad buys the Apple iPhone 13. He protects him. He feeds him. And then they're walking along the road one day, and a stranger's coming the opposite way, and the little boy says, Mister, have you seen my dad? Do you know where he is? And dad is not impressed. So he picks the little boy up off his shoulders, probably makes eye contact with him and says, where's dad? Where's dad? What? This is analogous to Hayesh Hashem b'kibbeinu emayim. Is God in our midst or not? So what does the father do? He casts the boy down by the side of the road. Adolf the pit bull, Haman the pit bull dog comes along, the Kelev, threatens the life of the little boy, and the little boy, Abba, Abba, please rescue me, Dad, Dad. Oh boy, then you remember where Avinu Shebashamayim is, our Father in Heaven. So in other words, the whole experience of our world today is very much like the experience of the Jews that we're going to talk about and experience together in the Megillah, where everything was hidden. There is a reason why the heroine is really not named Esther. Her name was Hadassah. But you know what Esther means? Of course, hidden. Because the entire story, the whole narrative, is hidden from the view of the average Jew. They were not privy to the inner workings. We are, in the Megillah, privy to the mental, even, workings of the main characters behind the scenes. They didn't know what was really going on. It was all hidden from them. And unfortunately, our world today is a massive hester panim, where God says, on that day, Anochi Esther Astir Panai, I'm going to hide my face from them. You're not going to know whether I'm there. You're going to have to look hard at the details of life. And of course, this is what it means to be a Jew. Which way do you want to live your life? Do you want to live your life as an Ish Yehudi, as a Jewish man like Mordechai and Esther? Or you want to live your life in the randomness of a Malek, that things just happen because we all know stuff happens, okay? So let's look at the historical context very, very briefly. I have it on Zoom for everybody. And this just gives you very briefly an overview of the 70 years that connects the Churban Bayit Rishon, the destruction of Temple Number 1 by King Nebuchadnezzar, more specifically Nebuzaradan, and then it connects us up to our story. So look at, just very briefly, so you have in the year 3338, which is the Jewish year, 422 before the Common Era, right, before the year zero, so you're going backwards. Thank you very much, Pope Gregory and Emperor Constantine for that one. So you have the destruction of the temple on Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av. You have King Nebuchadnezzar, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and you have prophecies both of Churban, of destruction, and Galut, and exile. And then you also have a prophecy of the return. So you have the exile led by Daniel and Ezra. Okay, so then you go a few short years later. So we're going backwards now. So it's only 49 years later, in the year 3387, you have Koresh. You have a proclamation, a pikida of King Cyrus of Persia. The Jews are allowed to return to Israel, and they can rebuild the temple. Only it doesn't happen. There's a proclamation, but there isn't a follow-through on that proclamation. Koresh, by the way, Cyrus, was a very righteous man, very righteous individual for the Jewish people. So a minority returns with Nehemiah, but most don't. They stay in Babylonia, in Babel. They're happy there under Belshazzar. Then in 3389, just a couple short years later, the foundations are laid for Beit Sheni, for the second temple. Ah, but one of the sons of Haman, at the behest of his dad, with the permission of Ahasuerus, just 1 year later, stops the construction, the rebuilding of the Beit Sheni, of the second temple. And then you have, in 3391, where we open, you have Ahasuerus's banquet in Shushan HaBirah, in the capital city of Shushan, using the kelim, the vessels, of the Beit HaMikdash that was ransacked by Nebuchadnezzar. And then, to close out our little narrative, our little context, you have in the year 3408, 352 BCE, you have the story of Purim, Mordechai and Esther, Second Temple completed 70 years after its destruction. You have the great Alexander the Great of Macedonia, and then you have the end of prophecy. So this historical context, and I'm going to stop the screen share, it just gives us all a sense of the time frame for the story of Purim. So we all see now that Purim is a very relevant period of time. It is sort of that dark period after the exile. And if anyone who remembers the class I gave on Tzom Gedalia, you remember that it was the murder of Gedalia ben Achikam that sort of was the final nail in the coffin, that the Jews were totally exiled. And the land of Israel, for a very short period of time, was shamem. It was absent of Jews. It was desolate. There was nothing going on in the land of Israel because of the assassination of the great Gedalia ben Achikam. And that's all in the book of Jeremiah. You want to read about it. Okay? So let's talk now about our story, Ahasuerus. And then we'll get into the verses. So who was Ahasuerus? So historically, people believe that he was a king named Xerxes. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. It's like E-X-E-R-E-S, Xerxes. Xerxes the, and I don't remember which number it was, okay? Which is probably a much easier name to sign. I'm sure after the game was over and Ahasuerus was signing autographs, you know, on the children's arms, it got a little tired, you know, like if your name's Nebuchadnezzar, Ahasuerus, I think Xerxes would be a lot easier. I think that's why kings develop the signet rings, you know, and then they don't have to sign their autograph. They can just, boom, right, hit you with a little ring and the seal. So it shall be written, so shall be done. Okay? So Ahasuerus was unique. And this is really important to the story. Because Ahasuerus was complicit with his wife, Queen Vashti, in a revolutionary moment. Now, who was Vashti? And who was Ahasuerus? So the rabbis have the most amazing debate on the qualities or lack thereof of Ahasuerus the king. You ready for this? Usually when the rabbis argue, you have like what they call an outlier, right? You have a position way out, chutz l'machana, and then everything else is sort of, that's way out there, everything else is sort of in between the outlier positions. You ready for this? So one of the Tanaim, one of the Mishnaic sages in Megillah says that Ahasuerus was a chacham. He was a brilliant politician and a brilliant man. And the other says, no, he was a shota. He's an idiot. He's a fool. That's kind of tough to reconcile a chacham and a shota in the same sentence. You know, it's a little strange. Okay? But who was he really? You know what he was? He was the world's first, I'm going to use a really bad word, and I apologize for swearing in shul. He was the world's first politician. That was humor, by the way. Okay. He really was a politician of enormous renown. He wasn't born with royal blood. He didn't have, you know, the gold little spoon in his mouth like most princes have. He wasn't a prince. He worked his way up the food chain, bribery, murder, you know, all the good Shakespearean tragic things, right? He was fun. But he was a brilliant guy when it came to knowing his fellow man. And he made himself the king. And we know this from the first verse. Because it says, "Vayehi b'mei Ahasuerus," this all happened in the days of Ahasuerus. And of course, somebody in the synagogue yells out, "Who? Who are you talking about?" That's a joke. "Who Ahasuerus? Who? The guy is Ahasuerus." And then the next word is Hamolech, who ruled, or was in the process, rather, of ruling. You don't call a melech the king. A molech, one who was in the process of attaining malchut, becoming the king, he is the king. You don't say he's in that process. No, he's in the process. You know why? Because he really wasn't, he wasn't of nobility. He had no blue blood. Now this is a huge issue. Why? Because if you're not born into it, if it is earned, remember the John Hussman for Smith Barney, right? They earn it the old-fashioned way. I'm really dating myself here, I'm sorry. Famous commercial. Smith Barney, they earn it. Commercials were better, weren't they? Like years ago, they had like a little focused little, you know, blurb, and you'll repeat it the rest of your life. And some ad guy is sitting back there going, "Yes, bravo, that'll be $20, Kaplan, for taking the tagline." So he earned his way up the food chain. Now, why this is so key is because when he throws his stock in with the triangle hat guy, Haman, it's a very big thing for him because he's a politician and he is now reliant on another individual for the vision of his kingdom. But his ego is enormous, like most kings, but he is fragile. He's fragile. Why? Because he's not self-assured at all. He's looking around at the palace and he's thinking, "I'm like a Johnny come lately, right? I'm the new kid in town." Sorry, that was an Eagles throw out there for those who remember. Right? Okay. Everyone online, I'm a big Eagles fan, okay? Johnny come lately? Okay. Yes, thank you, thank you. So he's the new kid in town. He's looking around and saying, I don't really belong. Somewhere in his gut, Ahasuerus was hypersensitive, excruciatingly so, to the nature of what it means to be the king, because he's like an interloper. Now, his wife? No, the wife Vashti, you know what we're told about Vashti? She's a regal person. She's a real queen. Her father was Belshazzar. Her Zadie, her grandfather, was Nebuchadnezzar himself. So Vashti's lineage, her yichus, her genetics were prime. They were real. Why do you think he married her? Because he wanted to solidify his standing in the eyes of the people. So here, Ahasuerus, we are told in the very first verse, and let's just do it inside the text, okay? I'll read it to you for those who may not have a text at home. Vayehi b'mei Ahasuerus, and it was in the days of Ahasuerus. Hu Ahasuerus, that Ahasuerus, Hamolech, we said now who is sort of in the process of ruling, Mehodu from India, the Adkush until Africa, Ethiopia area, Sheva, seven, the Esrim and Mea Medina, 127 provinces and countries. Wow. So that introduces us to a lot about Ahasuerus, right? We are told that he's not really the king. He's an interloper who made himself the king. He foisted himself on the people, okay? He marries Vashti in order to solidify his standing. But why did I say this was a revolutionary moment? So this, again, this Mahalech, this approach is from my Rebbe, Rabbi Weinberg, and it's very unique. So let me share it with you, okay? It's not the only approach, but I really believe it's emet. I believe this is the way to look at the Megillah. You see, everything that we're going to learn about in the first chapter was orchestrated, was a manipulation. If you think that our leaders today, you know, when they go on the camera and they have the, right, they have their little, the little, what's the thing called again that you look in?
Teleprompter.
The teleprompter. And they sit, like, you know, before they give the State of the Union, they'll sit with people for days, right, acting coaches, right? You'll have, like, Jeffrey Rush from the King's Speech, you know, helping King George. He'll also help, you know, President whoever. And they sit there and they go through each and every moment of the speech, and they parse every word, what it means. Up till the end, they're redacting every word that the president's going to say. So nothing is left to chance. Oh my gosh. These people are neophytes compared to Ahasuerus and Vashti. Because Ahasuerus and Vashti are going to undermine this system. And as a politician, Ahasuerus is creating a whole different type of world. No longer will it be sort of Nebuchadnezzar at the top of the food chain. And by the way, Vashti is his willing accomplice in the whole situation, right up till the end where things don't work out well for Vashti. But that's a story we'll get to. So what do they want to do? First thing, what do you do when you want to change history of a country? You move the capital. So Shushan had never been the capital of the Babylonian Empire before. Koresh, King Cyrus of Persia, Shushan, it had no meaning to anybody. So can you imagine, after hundreds of years of fame, uprooting the capital and moving it to this new place called Shushan? By the way, they have found where Shushan was, and they know exactly where the palace is, and they kind of know where the action takes place. It's a very formidable. So if you go online, archaeologists over in the Iraq area have discovered what they believe was the actual summer palace of Xerxes, which is fascinating. Okay, so this is like not just a biblical, this is a historical situation. So what happens? So when you're in Shushan HaBirah, when you declare Shushan to be the new capital, it's a new world. It's a brave new world. And it is revolutionary. So what's the first thing you learn when you hear about Ahasuerus? His over-the-top sense of grandeur. Right? He throws this insane party 180 days. And it describes the tapestries, the magnificence of every little detail. Nothing is left to chance. The wine on the menu. The rabbis say that they only gave you a wine that was 1 year older than you were chronologically. Which is probably okay when you're 25. But poor Ahasuerus is out there purchasing 70, 80, 90-year-old bottles of wine. And again, they didn't want to coerce anybody to drink, which was critical, as we'll talk about shortly. But the party, the 180 days, was specifically to show a new world. Vashti, Ahasuerus, Ahasuerus, Vashti. They were a team. They were complicit together. And then at the end of the 180 days, they have a seven-day party. And that seven-day party is specifically targeted to the locals of Shushan, where the capital is, and the big power brokers, I'm sure, amongst the 127 kings and leaders and princes and czars and whatever else were there, okay? So that's kind of where the party fits in. Vashti, in one of the other 4,000 rooms of the palace, she hosts the ladies of the world, and they have their own gig, their own party, concurrent with the men, right? They're very tzinius. They're very humble and modest. They want men and women to be separated, except when you want your wife to appear with no clothes in front of the men. That's okay to not be tzniastic, okay? But for the most part, they were separate. They were separating the sexes from each other. So let's go a little more into the text, okay? So read with me, please. And I'll just do it in the English, just for the sake of expedience, okay? So in those days, Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Shushan, the capital, and it was in the third year after he became king. He made a feast for all his officers, his servants, the army of Persia, Media, Parasu, Madai, the nobles and the officers of the countries were there. For a long time, for 180 days, he showed off the rich treasures of his kingdom and the beauty and greatness of his rule. And when these days ended, meaning at the end of 6 months, the king made a week-long party for everyone in Shushan, the capital, for the great people and the plain people, in the garden of the king's palace. And then it describes, it goes on to say in Pasuk Vav and Zion, you know, the grandeur, the splendor of the decor. And then in 7, it talks about the drinks were served in golden cups. No two cups were alike. And there was a lot of royal wine, as only a king could afford. And the drinks were served according to this rule. No one should be forced. No coercion. Big point. Please file that away. They did this because the king had ordered all his officials to do whatever every guest wanted. Turn the page, please. Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the palace of King Ahasuerus. And then on the seventh day, so it's the end of the 187 days. Wow. When the king was a little drunk, not a good thing. Shouldn't be driving. He spoke to, and the names of the following people were the seven main servants of Ahasuerus, Memucan, Bizesa, Harvona, Bigsa, Abika, right? So you get the idea. He ordered them to bring Vashti to him wearing her royal crown to show off her beauty to the people and the officer, for she was very beautiful. But Vashti refused to obey the order that the king had sent with the servants. The king became very furious, and he was burning with anger. Okay, let's stop. This is a very critical part of the story, right? Without this part of the story, there is no Esther. So let's back up. First of all, it doesn't mention anything about Yehudim, right? There's no Jews mentioned here. So Chazal, our rabbis, fill in the blanks. There were many Jews, the heads of the community of Shushan, specifically, who were invited to attend this feast. And their chief rabbi, Mordechai, said, no, you're not going. They're going to serve tarfas, trade food, not kosher. The wine could be yayin nesach, idolatrous types of wine. You don't go. You don't want to tick off Hashem. And the last day of the party was on Shabbat. So it's significant. Many of the Yehudim, many of the Jewish people, honored Mordechai, and they didn't go. Unfortunately, there were enough that went that Hashem was very, very unhappy. And it, according to some, is the cause and effect of Haman being let loose on the Jewish people. Because what did the king do at this party that was so offensive? You know what he did? He felt, I got a pass now. And he did a whole very contrived calculation. You see, 70 years was a prophecy. The Jewish people lose the temple, and then 70 years later, they're going to be redeemed and have a second temple. But when 70 years has passed without the Gula, right, without the redemption, hey, God has given up on the Jews. Or so thought, let's see, who thought that? Nebuchadnezzar thought that. Then Belshazzar thought that. And he died thinking that it was safe to play with God. And Ahasuerus, with his calculation, he believed that the 70 years had elapsed. No redemption, The Jews are a safe target. Hey, let's have fun. Let's punch out the Jews. So what did he do? He dusted off the begadim, the clothing, the 8 vestments worn once a year by the Kohen Gadol, by the high priest, when he would enter into the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh HaKodashim. He dressed himself like a Kohen Gadol. And the kelim, the some of the gold and things that they were serving everybody, those were kelim. Those vessels were not his vessels. They were God's vessels, stolen, looted from the temple. And he did it dafka. You know the word dafka? Spite. Just to spite the Jews. In other words, he wants the Jews to attend this party. He wants them to lose favor and lose hope. And so he's hoping more of them will come. So he's serving the best non-kosher, the best idolatrous wine. He specifically dresses in the levush, in the garments of the Kohen Gadol. Right? So you have all this anti-God stuff going on. And then, he decides that he's not going to coerce anybody to drink. So if the Jews are going to sin, it's going to be their choice. In other words, what if a Jew is coerced? So we say, halakhically, by Jewish law, is a person an ones? Meaning, you didn't have any choice in the matter. You were roped into it. It was against your will. Ones is a word actually used for rape. So in other words, were you spiritually raped by somebody? Coercion? Or was it bemezid? Did you do it deliberately? Are you a willful sinner? Or are you someone who was coerced? So you see that by the wine, etc., there was no coercion involved. Because Ahasuerus was smart enough to know that if you coerced the Jews, then they got it out. They could say, hey, God, we didn't want to buy into this. What choice did we have? The king invited us. He forced us to eat and drink and imbibe. Okay, so we were there. So the fact that the Jews attend the party, chaval, it's a horrific, horrific mistake. It's a horrible avera. All right, so what happens? On the seventh day, the rabbis say that in his drunken stupor, along with the drunken stupor of the shared kings, who were his best pals and lifelong friends, they start to have this insane argument about beauty. Where are the most beautiful women to be found? California, by the way, didn't exist yet. So, okay. Sweden didn't make the cut. So everyone came up with their own cheshbon. You know, I'm sure the guy from Egypt, the Egyptian women, the Cushite women, maybe Ethiopian prince, everybody chimed in with their thought process. Ahasuerus said, look, I'm sure your women are beautiful. But Persian women, I got to tell you, they're the best of all. And I have the most magnificent specimen in the world, Vashti, my queen. And if you don't believe me, I'll tell her to come and she'll show off her beauty. She'll wear Beketer HaMalchut, the crown of the kingdom. The rabbis say, but nothing else. It's okay, it's a little PG-13 here, I'm sorry. Okay, so Vashti is having her good old time in another part of the palace. This is all thought out, part of the conspiracy here. To bring Vashti in, to demean Vashti, you demean her dad, Belshazzar, you demean Nebuchadnezzar. It's all part and parcel of this whole nefarious plot to undermine the past, right? To uproot the past, to go forward with a new vision. It all comes crashing down, because what happens to poor Vashti? She gets pimples, whatever, she gets a bad attack of acne. And it's a busha, it's a disgrace, it's an embarrassment. And Vashti can't come looking like an embarrassing queen. She's going to undermine, her appearance will undermine everything that they have accomplished. And so Vashti, instead of just simply begging off. You know what she does? It's kind of hard to believe, but she does. She gets angry. She gets ticked off. She was so vain. And by the way, if you pity Vashti, don't pity Vashti. Everything that happened, happened on Shabbat. You know what Vashti used to do on Shabbat? Real piece of work here. She used to specifically only have young Jewish girls work for her as slaves. And she would have them work without any clothes on Shabbat, specifically to do malacha, creative work on Shabbat. So God strips Vashti, if you will, of her clothing, the levush that we wear, her downfall, mida keneged mida, measure for measure, delightfully comes on Shabbat to pay Vashti back for her evil. So Vashti doesn't just say no to the king. Like, in other words, just check out. Even write him a little letter. Your Royal Highness, I know we have a whole plan, but I have a very bad case of acne and it's not going to cure. I can't come. Sorry, love, Vashti. No, no, she doesn't do that. The messenger that comes and has the chutzpah, right? The audacity to invite Vashti, she responds irrationally. And she says to the messenger, sir, get out your quill. Take this down word for word, right? And I always love this because you can picture the poor guy and he has to deliver this message to a drunk and outraged king. Okay? She says, you know, this is all in the Megillah in the Gemara. She says, tell Ahasuerus that he's a big fat idiot. He's a fool. To treat me, royalty, in such an undignified way? If my Zaidi, Nebuchadnezzar, was king right now, Ahasuerus couldn't get a gig. He couldn't be part of the gig economy cleaning up manure from the horse stalls. He's not even fit for that. You got it? You write it down, and the poor guy's probably shaking because, you know the expression of Caesar, you know, could kill the messenger? I wouldn't want to be delivering this message to King Ahasuerus. So the guy goes back to Ahasuerus. Vashti never makes her appearance. Ahasuerus is waiting. You know, he's looking at his watch. Sundial. What's going on? Where's Vashti? He's wondering. No Vashti. Oh, my gosh. And you can feel the palpable tension in the room, right? Because he has just ordered his wife to come. This was way before, right, the suffragette movement, okay? There was no suffragette movement in Persia. Now women had no rights. So she's not coming. And then, of course, the messenger comes from FedEx, and he delivers the fateful blow. And everyone there is aghast, including Ahasuerus. She doesn't know what to do. Now, at that moment in history, and this is delightful, there was a protocol for how situations like this were handled. You ready for the protocol? The Megillah actually says this. You'll read this yourself. Here's the protocol. When you were going to issue an edict, you couldn't sign the way, unfortunately, some of our presidents of the past, all of them, right? You know, they have like presidential, what's it called? The direct, they have a name for it. You know, when the president issues executive orders. Thank you. Executive orders. There aren't executive orders. Ahasuerus had like a Senate. Aye. He had a Congress. He had the Yodea Itim. He had these people who were his official appointed counselors and advisors. They were politicians. And he would have to sort of run by them what he had in store. And that could take months. We know how slow Washington is. No different in Persia, okay, in Shushan. All right. So he consults the seven wise men. And I'll list them for you, okay, because this is really, really important. This is now in 13. We're skipping to 13. Actually, we did everything beforehand. Then the king spoke with his wise men. For the king used to discuss problems with people who knew the rules and the laws, right? These are the senators, the congressmen. The wise men closest to him, and it lists a whole bunch of them. Take a look at the last guy's name. They're listed in order of chashivut, of importance. His name was Memuchan, who were the seven officers of Persia and Media, Paras and Madai, who were always allowed to see the king and who were the highest officers of the kingdom. King Ahasuerus wanted them to tell him the right way to punish Queen Vashti for not obeying the order that he had sent with the servants. And then Memuchan spoke up before the king. Now, just to give you a little background, Memuchan apparently was like the least of the seven. That's clear by the order. And he was like a garnished. He was just like a backbencher. Right? He's the guy from Wyoming. You don't even know, right? He happens to be there because Wyoming has a population of what? You know, a million? But you get two senators. So he's the guy from Wyoming who's there. But he never weighed in on any important decision. The other six are petrified. And the Megillah adds that before he came to the seven, guess who he called upon? The Jews, of course. So he called the Jews in, the rabbis, right? He's got to have a fall guy. So he says to the Jews, to the rabbis, okay, rabbis, here's the scenario. Vashti, she refuses to come. This is what she did. What are my options? The rabbis say, Your Royal Highness, can you wait 1 minute? And they go outside and they consult. They say, you know, there's no good ending for us here. Right now, in his anger and in his shikur, and his drunken state, the king wants the head of Vashti on a plate. So if we tell him, spare her, he's going to kill us right now for the advice. But if we say get rid of her, which is what he wants, tomorrow morning, in addition to the 12 Advil headache that he's going to wake up with, he's going to want a fall guy. He's going to say, what happened? Oh, it was the Jews who suggested I kill Vashti. So whatever we tell him, Miman HaShach, whatever we say, we're done. We're dead. So the Jews did the smartest thing ever. You know what they came back with? We don't know. We don't know. Right? Best line ever. We're not sure. Ask your guys. So you ask the seven. Six clearly are like the Jewish rabbis. Right? They are saying, we're not weighed in with this one. And this Memuchan character gets up in the back. And he's the one who basically says, not only did Vashti insult His Royal Highness, every man in the kingdom has now been diminished by the actions of this woman. Because every husband is going to say to his wife, hey, make me some breakfast. The wife is going to say, but Vashti didn't come when the king ordered him. I'm not making you your eggs. Make them yourself, you fool. So every man in the entire kingdom, 127 kingdoms, has been hurt and diminished by the actions of this Vashti. So it's not just the sin. Lo asa Vashti, she didn't just sin against you. She sinned against all of mankind. Mankind, not womankind. So let's get rid of her. Let her sleep with the fish. And then send out an igeret, send out a letter, and this letter should be the focal point, saying that every man has to be the moshel, the ruler in his house. He has to rule over his wife. And this is critical, okay? We're winding down. Why is it critical? Because the king, to our knowledge, only sent out two official dispatches by horse, by rider, by pony express. The first one is this letter stating every man has to rule his wife. Trust me when I tell you, this is Saudi Arabia. Every man ruled his wife, okay? So they're looking at this much anticipated communique from the king. And what is in it? You have to be a ruler over your wife. And they're thinking, Tipesh, the king's an idiot. Why is this so critical? Ah, I'm glad you asked. Because when the second igeret is sent out, the igeret, the letter that says, get ready for next Adar 13, without wink wink mentioning the Jews, what if that letter was taken seriously by the people who love the king? They'll say, you know, this is such a great letter. Let's not wait till 13th of Adar of next year, which is like 11 months from now. Let's kill the Jews now. We'll have fun. No, they didn't do it because they remembered this is the same idiot king who sent that letter about his queen Vashti. You know what? We'll wait. Maybe things will change. Maybe his opinions about the Jews will change between now and Adar 13. So that actually saved the Jews, this crazy letter that he sends out. Who sent out that crazy letter? This guy Memuchan. Do you know who Memuchan is? He's Haman. That's great. So in other words, for Haman's first action that ends up destroying himself is the counsel that he gives to the king, right? Because number one, he kills Vashti. It's on his say-so. Without that edict, there's no Esther. That's clear. It's bullshit, right? Second, the igeret, right? Suggesting that he sends this royal proclamation. It sets the stage for his own igeret that he gets permission from later with the stamp of the king, right? With the sigil on that stamp. But his stupid letter prevents the Jews from being killed unceremoniously in advance of the 11 months and allows Esther and Mordechai a window of opportunity to save the day. Now, how do we know that this is true? Because the Gemara says, Memuchan, he is Haman. How do you know this? Well, you're the rabbis and you have the Masorah, you have the tradition from Sinai. You know how they know it, though? Listen to this. It's amazing. Gemara says, why was Haman called in the first chapter of the book of Esther? Why is he called Memuchan? The word Memuchan comes to the word Muchan. So some of you may know that word, Hachana, preparation. You're not allowed to prepare, for example, on a Shabbat for a day that's not Shabbat. Or you can't prepare on Yom Tov day one for Yom Tov day two. It's called Hachana. It's called preparation. So why is he called Mr. Preparation? Why this nickname? You know why? It's delightful. So the rabbis say, he, Haman, is called Memuchan. Why? Because he's Muchan Lefuranut. He is prepared to take a fall. He is always going to wind up on the losing side of the equation. And because of this, he's always Mr. Memuchan. In other words, he's going to maximize the prep, and all the prep is going to be used by God to undermine Haman. And so therefore, when we meet Mr. Memuchan, Haman, right, we're introduced to this character. He is already sort of, there's a foreshadowing that his action, his plans are all going to be ultimately Baruch Hashem v'nahapachu, right? It's all going to come turned about and back against him in the end. So let me end with the following. I'll ask everyone to close their book for a moment, and then we're going to wrap up with just a thought here, okay? And hopefully you'll come back, as I say in Memphis, you'll come back next week for part two. All righty? This is going to whet your appetite, I promise. Okay. If Haman is Memuchan, Mr. Preparation, it might explain one of the weirdest scenarios in the Megillah. Now, I'm going way, way ahead of myself here, but you'll know the story. Do you remember when Haman barges in the middle of the night because he can't wait to ask for permission from King Ahasuerus to build the gallows to kill Mordechai, right? In other words, just wait, Haman, you idiot. Next 13th of Adar, the letter went out, Mordechai's a Jew, he'll be killed. No, I'm not waiting. Even in the middle of the night, I'm going to wake up the king. Mi b'chatzer, who's that outside? It's 2 a.m., right? But the king's not sleeping because the king just found out that Mordechai saved his life and was never rewarded. Ah, here comes Haman. So he doesn't give Haman a chance to say anything. He says, Haman, oh, marvelous, you're here. I love you. I rely on you. Tell me, what do I do for the man who has everything? Right? And Haman thinks, of course, he must be talking about moi. Me, because I'm the best and the brightest. So Haman comes up with this insane... Let me ask you. Okay. Let's say you want to be rewarded by Mr. Jobs. Okay? I don't like the guys who are the rich guys today, but I like Steve Jobs. Okay? So Steve Jobs says to you, you know, Rabbi, you know, people of Ovid Tzedek, I love you so much. So in honor of everything that you have done, just name your price, any reward in the world. I don't think I would ask for Steve Jobs' own personal car and to be paraded around like on the horse or in the, you know, the Bentley of Steve Jobs for one afternoon. And everyone gets to see me parade around in Steve Jobs' Bentley with Apple license plates or something. Like, come on, really? That's the best you can do? I would ask for maybe some stock, some shares in Apple. That would be a nice reward, right? Cryptocurrency, perhaps, right? Something. You ask for a horse and the crown of the king, like this is your reward? You know what it is? It's Haman believing that he can overcome his Mr. Preparation limitations. You see, as Mr. Preparation, he throws out enormous amounts of hishtadlut, work to kill the Jews. And it's going to stick somewhere. And he believes that he can ride the horse of the king. He didn't ask for the horse of Ahasuerus, the king. In his own mind, he asked for God's horse. How do we quantify, by the way, I use Steve Jobs and the Bentley very specifically, okay? How do you quantify the... In Europe, they use something called kilowatts, which are not sexy. Okay, how many kilowatts does your Ferrari have? But what do in America, in England, in the UK, the home of Formula One? Horsepower, right? Did you ever think how stupid it is? Horsepower? We still use it today. You still say, oh my gosh, my Ferrari's got 655 horsepower. Do you know what that means? Of course not. You don't know the arithmetic of what it means. You know that means it's a powerful... How much horse work could a horse do in one hour? Good. And in agricultural society, I'm sure you knew that answer. But today, how many people know that, right? You don't even... Ever thought of how ridiculous it is that we still quantify energy by horsepower? So listen what the Medrash says. The Medrash says, what is the world like? It's like a horse and a rider. Who is in charge of whom? Is the horse in charge of the rider, or is the rider in charge of the horse? So the Midrash says you my thing, because the horse is so big that he is leading the rider around wherever he wants. No. The rider leads the horse. He decides how to utilize the horsepower, the energy. Haman asks for the king's horse. You know why? Because he wants to take the horsepower that he has emitted through his preparation. Remember, he's Memucan. He's throwing all his stuff out there, building this and doing that and decreeing this and letter, you know, all the little details. Hundreds of them are there in the Megillah, right? And he throws them out as horsepower. And he believes, Haman and his hubris, that I will ride the horsepower and I will sit on that horsepower and I can push it against Mordechai. I can push it against the Jews. I will destroy them. And when he gets on the horse belonging to the king, guess what he discovers? Sorry, Haman. You're a rider. You're a rider. God ordains the horsepower. It's God's horse. And all that horsepower that you emitted and put out there, you know what Hashem says to you? Yasher Koach. Job well done, Mr. Haman. Every horsepower that you emitted, I'm going to utilize each and every one so deliciously to kill you and to undermine you and your people. And so he becomes the man who thought he could harness the horsepower as God, Kibiachol, and then he understands in the end, as he's brought up to the gallows, right, as they throw the black thing over his head and he's being led away, at that moment, Haman realizes, oh my gosh, here I thought that I could do the prep work and I could harness the horse of the king. No, God's going to have the last laugh. And this, of course, is the nature of our world, where we try our best as good people to just emit as much hishtadlut, to do our job as Jews the best we can. And in the end, Hashem is going to take our input and, please God, give back our response. But we dare not ever think, we're not arrogant. We dare not think that we have the ability to direct it. All we have the ability is to do our best and hope that Hashem will take it and apply it where we want it to be applied. And this is a huge theme that we're going to develop a little more as we continue on. So please join us next week for part 2. Same channel, next Thursday night. Thank you, everyone.